I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere, a holistic exploration of individual health, community, and culture. The topics we'll be discussing on this show will address health for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hello, everyone. This is Kevin and Sam, and we're here tonight with Dr. Amy Chadwick, naturopathic doctor who practices here in Palmer. And we're going to talk about gluten tonight. We're going to talk about what it is, why it seems to be such a health issue for so many people. And we want to find out how you find out if you do have a wheat intolerance or a gluten intolerance, or if you have a full-blown condition known as celiac disease. So Sam, maybe tell a little bit about Amy?
Yes, I want to do a little introduction on Dr. Amy Chadwick. But first, if you've been to our Facebook page, we have a whole bio and information on gluten-free already up there, and we'll have some more information up there after the broadcast. But let me give you an idea of the topics we're going to try to cover this evening. And all of these we're really going to be able to cover probably just on the surface level, and we'll definitely have Dr. Chadwick back in the future so we can go into depth on more of these topics. But we're going to go into diagnosis options on celiac disease. We're going to talk about what is the actual difference between celiac and gluten intolerance, because I know that's a major confusion for some people. We're going to look at the difference between a wheat allergy and gluten intolerance. And then we're also going to look at other illnesses that tend to be aggravated by gluten intolerance. We're going to have some tips on living gluten-free. And we're going to talk about why this seems like suddenly it's such a huge issue in our culture. You know, what's behind that? Why are so many more people finding themselves gluten intolerant? And then we have some questions. We already have one listener who's written in with a question. But if you have more questions and you'd like to write into our Facebook page, we'll take your question and we'll pose it to Dr. Chadwick on air. We'll keep her on her toes.
Yeah, just go to Facebook/Bridge to Everywhere and you'll find us, and you can just put in the comments section your question.
So here's a little bit of Dr. Chadwick's bio, and then you can read the rest of it on the Facebook page, and I'm sure we'll get a little bit more in-depth as we go along. But Dr. Amy Chadwick has been a practicing naturopathic medicine in Palmer since 1986. As a business owner, doctor, yoga teacher, wife, dog owner, foodie, photographer, meditator, and lover of life, Amy also lives entirely gluten-free. After a lifetime of headaches, fatigue, and a variety of other non-specific health issues, Amy chose to take her own advice and eliminate gluten from her diet 3 years ago. Upon reintroduction 6 weeks later, it was immediately apparent that she had a strong intolerance to gluten. So I just want to note that Amy's going to be talking some from personal experience, and I think that'll really help some people in our audience. So welcome, Dr. Chadwick. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. And definitely not practicing since 1986. I'm
no,
not that
I
old.
Said, that's 1996. Sorry, 1996?
That's not even quite right. But
graduated from middle school and went
graduated from middle school and became a naturopathic practitioner. So she's got a lot of experience. Okay. So so let's just talk about some of the basics here and talk about, you know, how you might decide that somebody in your practice has a gluten allergy. You know, what's the first thing that might cue you in to somebody who's got a gluten allergy?
Good question. Actually, just read a research article today talking about celiac and gluten intolerance and saying that the best screening test that we have is to suspect celiac or gluten intolerance. And so have it be something that comes into your mind on the forefront for a lot of different conditions. Because it is something that I work with a lot, I certainly suspect it when I see people with digestive disturbances, whether that's diarrhea, gas or bloating, irritable bowel type syndrome, things that have been given kind of not clear diagnoses but are chronic digestive issues. I definitely look for a gluten intolerance there. Gluten intolerance, though, also plays out with anxiety, with headaches, with joint pain, with other autoimmune diseases, with skin issues. So there's not a lot that comes in my office where I don't at least consider it as an option.
And I think a lot of people tend to think that dairy is the big allergen in our Western diet.
Yeah.
And I think that you've noticed, and I've also noticed over the years, that it seems to be gluten is really taking the number one spot. Is that that's what you're seeing in your practice pretty much?
It is definitely what I'm seeing. And I would actually say that there's the possibility that a gluten intolerance causes a lactose intolerance, and that oftentimes dairy is eliminated and people feel better for a period of time. but it's not until the gluten's eliminated that symptoms really are taken care of. Dairy also can be a cofactor with gluten, so people can have both sensitivities.
Can a gluten intolerance heal over time? Is it a reflection of a digestive system that has been compromised, and over time a person could add gluten back into their diet?
We don't know that for sure. My general theory with most food allergies is that yes, we can reverse food allergies when we work with healing the digestive system and balancing the immune system, that most food allergies go away. I'm not sure that that's true with gluten intolerance, and it's partly because of the mechanism of what gluten is doing in the digestive tract. There's a sensitivity to the gluten proteins, which then triggers kind of in cartoon version, it triggers a leaky gut, and then that leaking triggers an inflammatory response that builds on itself and creates a cycle that may not be reversible. Every time that person is exposed to gluten, they're going to have that inflammatory response.
Could you describe maybe in some simple terms what leaky gut is?
Yeah, it's basically the cells of the small intestine are meant to be really tight and close together, so that food particles, when they're fully digested, actually are absorbed through the intestinal cells. So from one side of the cell through the cell itself into the other side. And when that happens, the immune system on the other side of that gut cell is able to recognize it as food and say, great, you're food. And we actually develop all of our tolerance to food through that mechanism. So there's a arm of the immune system that says, your food, I'm not going to fight you, I'm not going to create an inflammatory response, I'm going to let you through and let you feed the body. If there's inflammation in the digestive tract, we can develop what we think are little gaps between those digestive cells. And when there are gaps between those cells, proteins that are not completely digested will slip between those cells, and that will set off alarms in the immune system. And when alarms go off in the immune system, I like to equate it to a fire alarm going off in a theater. It's never calm, it's never orderly, and that is part of the reason we see this wide array of different symptoms. With gluten intolerance is that basically the body's in alarm mode.
And that accounts for the nervous system conditions.
Correct.
Anxiety.
Yeah, there's that, plus there's some theory that some evidence to say that gluten proteins can act on opiate receptors in the nervous system directly. So if those proteins are absorbed without being fully broken down, they can directly target opiate receptors in the nervous system and therefore dysregulate neurochemistry.
Yeah, so two things from that. I've heard several people describe for little kids that have compromised digestive tract that eating a pizza is basically equivalent of giving them heroin.
Yes.
Between the dairy,
the dairy and the
gluten. Yeah, you've got the casein protein and you've got the gluten protein, and for some little kids, you might as well just be giving them some heroin.
Yes,
if their reaction
absolutely.
To it. And the other thing I've heard you said that goes back to the leaky gut, which I think is a really good point, because there's such a focus now, and people come into our office a lot of times with allergy tests, mm-hmm. and they're often blood tests, mm-hmm. and they're allergic to 30 or 40 different things, and they're all the things that the person is currently eating. And so they're very confused, and they don't know what to make of that data. And they're like, well, I've been eating this all my life. What's the problem? So can you kind of further expand on that, like why they're getting that result on the test and what it means in terms of leaky gut?
Yeah, so an allergy response is an allergy test, a blood allergy test, is looking at how the immune system is responding to different food triggers. And if the gut is leaky, if there are those gaps between the cells, then there's the possibility for any proteins not fully broken down to absorb in between those cells. And every single one of those will trigger the immune response to say, I don't recognize this. I don't recognize it as food. So during the time that the gut is inflamed, an allergy test will show multiple food allergies that once we heal that gut lining, even though gluten may still be an issue or whatever the original offending food may be, the rest of the food allergies will often disappear at that point.
So if you had somebody in that situation, the first thing you would suspect is that this is likely a gluten issue. This is what's going on.
I always look for the biggies, mm-hmm. And gluten is the first one. Mm-hmm. There are sometimes, for a few people, there's something else, but gluten is always the first thing, even if it doesn't show up positive on the allergy test, mm-hmm. because a gluten intolerance is not always an allergy per se.
Interesting. That brings up the question from a listener in Atlanta, Georgia.
Dr. Anna Kelly.
Dr. Anna Kelly. And she wanted,
hi, Anna.
She wanted to know, what is the most sensitive test for gluten sensitivity that has a low false positive rate? So are you aware of any?
The best test for gluten sensitivity is elimination and challenge. That's still the gold standard for gluten sensitivity. There are tests for celiac disease that are much more effective and should be implemented if we suspect celiac disease. And that's one of the reasons why it is important to work with your doctor if you think you have a gluten intolerance, because there are long-term consequences of celiac disease that need to be addressed differently than a gluten intolerance. So eliminating gluten, re-challenging, and finding that you're having symptoms, you definitely want to follow that up by checking to see if you potentially do have some other disease.
So let's go into that then, the difference between what would be a gluten intolerance versus somebody who has actual.
And maybe before we do that, what is the standard for the time when you withdraw wheat from your diet? How much time minimally is required to really get good feedback?
I find it takes 4 to 8 weeks, depending on the person.
Will people notice symptomatic relief, immediately, or can it really take as many as 4 to 6 weeks to actually see some resolution?
Most people notice that they feel better in one realm or another fairly quickly. Okay. You know, within a week of getting rid of gluten, most people will notice changes in energy, changes in sleep, perhaps joint pain. Even within a week, if they slip up and eat gluten, they may notice things like the brain fog or a digestive disturbance, even within 1 week of being off. The 6 to 8 weeks gives people a chance for their digestive system to actually heal, and so they begin actually recognizing that the food they're eating is feeding them, and they feel more nutrient-dense and therefore feel better in all respects at that point.
So here's a question I have based on that, is that I do have some people say, well, I tried that, taking gluten out. You know, and in some cases I check in and they've actually really done it seriously. They've taken the gluten out, but they say, well, I didn't notice any difference. So I wonder in that case, is there something else that they're really allergic to? It's one, but the other thing is maybe there's some other serious condition going on that may have been caused by the gluten, but 6 weeks isn't enough for that to heal. Is that
definitely
possible?
Definitely. I also think because some of the symptoms can be really subtle, we don't know what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes if somebody says they didn't notice anything, we'll start having questions about sleep or about energy or about feeling anxious or sensitivity to the rest of your world, how sensitive you are to light, sound, noise, smell, skin issues, level of pain. And the pain may not have completely gone away, but it may have felt better during that time. You know, for me, my gluten sensitivities are a headache that comes on very quickly. So I have that marker. Even if I get the tiniest exposure, I know right away that I got that exposure. But it's taken me a time to figure out what happens over the next few days. And for me, that's a increased level of irritability, which, you know, anybody around me recognizes in that time.
Amy had some toast this morning.
It's an increased tendency to drop things. Like, I get clumsier for a couple of days after I eat gluten. I feel foggy. My brain doesn't work as clearly. I get more anxiety. I get more sensitive to sound, smell, light. So all of those things are pretty subtle and aren't the things that a lot of us are paying attention to on a daily basis.
Right, and that's great to point out that those things are in the realm of subtle, and since a lot of us live as though we're a head floating up in space, not attached to your body, it does help to often, if somebody says to me, I didn't notice anything, then I'll say, well, what did your husband notice? What did your kids notice? What did your boss notice? What did your employees notice? And sometimes other people in their environment will notice it first.
Right.
So it's always a good question to ask.
And it is possible. I mean, there are certainly people who don't have a gluten intolerance. So for some, they eliminate it and they don't notice a difference. And we have to be looking at something else. We're not always that tells us we're not working in the right system and we have to look somewhere else. And there may be a more severe illness, like you said, that is masking that as well, that there are just too many symptoms. The body has kind of fallen apart in too many ways, and it's going to take time to heal that back up.
And I did have a patient one time who turned out her severe allergy was corn.
Mm-hmm.
It was not gluten. It wasn't actually soy, and it was shocked to everybody. You know, and it probably took 2 years to get down to the fact that it was corn, and corn, because corn isn't everything.
Right.
So she kept doing all these elimination diets, but she was still eating some packaged food, and so the high fructose corn syrup and the corn-made products showed up, and as soon as she got all those things out, that was what really turned things around.
Yeah.
So it was a humbling experience to go through that. So sometimes it does take quite a bit of tenacity to just hang in there and figure out what it is.
And it also takes looking at cofactors, because oftentimes people who have a gluten intolerance will also have a corn and potentially a soy intolerance. And a lot of the gluten-free foods have quite a bit of corn and soy in them. So they may not feel better being gluten-free because they're still eating these foods that are pretty high in cofactors. So we have to – that's another piece where I really emphasize if you choose to try gluten-free, that you stick with whole foods during that time in order to get a clear picture.
That is a really good point, because there's so much gluten-free products on the market, and it's like literally the marketers are having their way. You know, they'll be sticking gluten-free on a stalk of broccoli pretty soon. You know, just so everybody wants gluten-free as if it's automatically a healthy thing. And you know, you can just get a box of crackers or a box of gluten-free cookies, and you can look at the list of ingredients, and it's anything but healthy, really.
Yeah. Gluten-free doesn't mean healthy. You know, and that's the other kind of misunderstanding in our culture at this point, is that gluten-free has become a little bit of a fad, and it's not necessarily helping those of us who have gluten intolerances, but it means there's a lot of products available, and I certainly am thankful that there's a easy gluten-free cookie on the market, but I don't ever eat that thinking that I'm eating something good for me.
Right. I think that's a misunderstanding, that what you just said, that gluten-free doesn't mean healthy. The goal of somebody who's marketing a product and calling it gluten-free, if you're going to make a gluten-free brownie, it's basically all the junk that's in the brownie, and they're just making it have the same taste and the same texture and the same experience as you would get eating a brownie that has gluten in it.
Correct.
But all the other stuff's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
And then there may be some other weirdness in there just to give it that. I mean, what do you have to
it
do
takes
to
more work?
Right. Yes, yeah, to get the thing to rise, or to have a particular crispy crunch, or to get, you know, the what is it that with gluten, like the sort of Play-Doh.
Right.
And it tastes more like technology than
yeah.
it tastes like a cookie. Or
right. Yeah. And that's, so all those things, you know, who do you, I mean, I know xanthan gum is, for some people, that's fine, but that's just weirdness. What is that? You know, it's like bacteria slime.
It is. It's a binder. So
yeah.
It helps hold everything
right.
together.
I mean, yes, like egg yolks, or, you know, so I prefer to use ground flax. It's just, but there are some things that you're, like there's just odd ingredients that our bodies are not used to encountering necessarily as food in large quantities.
Yeah, and a lot of the grains that we replace gluten with are really low nutrient density grains. So white rice flour is a common substitute, but white rice doesn't have a lot of nutrients or a lot of fiber to it. So we may replace with that, but we're actually getting sort of a higher sugar containing, higher glycemic index type food when we make that straight replacement.
So somebody who's got an issue with blood sugar might not be better off making the switch to your rice flour.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. They may do very well being gluten-free, but we need to work with which grains they're using and which ones they aren't at that point.
Do you have some websites that you can refer people to discover gluten-free recipes, ideas for cooking that really is exclusively focused on whole foods? Maybe even a book or an author.
Exclusively focused on whole foods makes it harder. Definitely. There are...
While you're looking, I can mention some.
Yeah.
I know this funky coconut is good. They try to do gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free. Then they do focus a lot on dessert. So people who are looking for the dessert experience, this funky coconut is usually where I send people.
Yes.
There are some good recipes there. And then the Nourished Kitchen,
mm-hmm.
which is based more on Weston Price philosophy, so it's whole foods. That's usually – I don't think it's completely gluten-free, but there's a lot of gluten-free recipes on there. And then I think the other one we like is Elena's Pantry.
Yes.
Is another one. That one's gluten-free.
Yeah.
And Eating for Evolution with
Tiffany Pollard.
I also I really like Gluten-Free Girl. Gluten-Free Girl and the Chef, or glutenfreegirl.com. I appreciate her because she and her husband really appreciate food. And so they really test their recipes. They don't put anything out until they know that it's going to taste good. And they do provide a lot of baking recipes, but they're also doing a lot of whole foods. In fact, there's a video on their site today on how to cook quinoa. So there's some really basic tips on there, as well as some more advanced fun food. There's also a new one, Canelate Vanilla, and I'm sure I'm not saying it right, but they've just put out a new cookbook called Small Plates and Sweet Treats that is all naturally gluten-free foods. So rather than trying to use substitutes in order to create baked goods, it's looking at other cultures that naturally eat in a gluten-free way and using the recipes in that
That's
way.
Interesting.
So that one's Small Plates and Sweet Treats, and it is still on pre-order from Amazon.
Okay. And we'll get you to email some of this to us so we can put it up on the Facebook page after the broadcast.
And we should take this opportunity to put a plug in for the Red Beet Bistro, because we here in the Valley have the only entirely gluten-free facility, restaurant, bakery in the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. That's the Red Beet Bistro right off of the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. And we spoke with Sally last night just to get a feeling for all the products that they're making and how they're doing it.
And Sally actually says their motto is, if we don't put it, we won't put it on the shelf if it can't pass. So she's actually challenging people to come in, and like if you're used to eating a traditional pie dough, she challenges you to come in and try her pie dough and see if you notice a difference. So that, and they actually have gluten-free English muffins, which tastes pretty close to English muffins. And because everything in the facility is gluten-free, if somebody's really concerned about gluten-free, that would be if you wanted to eat out, that would really be one of the few places you could go without being concerned that, you know, you've got gluten being added to your food in some form or another. I know Amy personally has had some experiences where she requests gluten free and then they come with, you know, the bun sitting on it. Oh, but the bun doesn't have gluten in it, that's wheat, right? So, you know, and then you can't just at that point take the bun off of whatever it is that you're eating, because it's for somebody who's got a serious gluten intolerance, even just having the bun sitting on the food, or, you know, even if the pasta's on the plate and it's potentially touched the food, for some people who are that sensitive, and I think we'll get into celiac a little bit here, that's just not possible.
Correct.
So to go to a facility that says we don't, and they also, Red Beet doesn't use corn or soy either. They only use corn as a vegetable.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that really impressed me about our conversation with Sally is, she says, we don't use any processed anything. They don't use potato starch. They use the potato. And they'll use pureed beet to help the rising dough. They're really not using all this junky filler. It's all whole foods in what they're preparing.
So, and they're on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway, and I believe Sally said that they are just getting their new website up. I think is it redbeetbistro.com?
I'm not sure, but we'll have it linked in on our Facebook page.
Okay, so is it time to talk about the difference between celiac and gluten intolerance?
I think that would be great.
Okay, all right, we're going to go there now. Okay, so that's a big point of confusion for people, is what does it mean if you actually have celiac? What is celiac as a disease? And then what versus gluten intolerance? What does that actually mean?
Okay. For me, it's an important distinction, because even in the words we've used today about actually have celiac or as bad as celiac or those kinds of words is confusing. And there's been a lot of history in learning about gluten intolerance and celiac. And up until the last couple of years, it was assumed that celiac was sort of the worst form of gluten intolerance that you could have. So that maybe there was a spectrum, and therefore if you were gluten intolerant, you could probably tolerate some gluten, but if you were celiac, you couldn't tolerate any. That model is changing. And so the model that I look at in my clinic is that I look at it like the spokes of a wheel, and at the center of that wheel is gluten intolerance. So gluten intolerance is the kind of the ultimate foundation. Those spokes all reach out. One of those spokes goes out to celiac disease. Celiac disease is an autoimmune condition, specifically of the digestive tract, where we develop antibodies to our own digestive cells in response to gluten. But Hashimoto's thyroid, or autoimmune thyroid, is another spoke of that wheel, where instead of developing antibodies to our own digestive lining, we develop antibodies to our thyroid gland. Potentially some disorders such as inflammatory bowel disease, IBS, maybe some forms of cancer, arthritis, anxiety, neurological disorders like autism and ADHD, those all may be other spokes on that wheel. Not that lots of those don't have other causes as well, but that gluten intolerance at the center can play a role in all of those other illnesses. So that then gives us a little different model to work with, and gives us more room for understanding why somebody may not have celiac disease, but their sensitivity to gluten is just as sensitive and just as extreme as somebody who has the diagnosis of celiac disease.
So that makes a lot of sense to me, and why it's often so confusing to determine what's going on, to think about gluten intolerance at the center and all these other pieces sort of as spokes coming off of the wheel. Because I had that in my head, even though I've seen all this stuff that you're talking about, I still had that in my head that it was on a continuum and celiac disease was actually the worst end of that continuum. And so to reframe it that way, I think really helps. And I think it really will help people to understand why gluten intolerance is at the root of these other autoimmune conditions.
Correct.
So that So let's talk a little, let's get into a little bit of that. I don't know how much we'll get into before the break, but we can start and then we'll pick it up.
And I want to know, what are the specific mm-hmm. symptoms of celiacs? Like, what are the common symptomatic profiles?
Yeah, let's do that first.
Yeah. Okay. So celiac causes digestive symptoms. Generally, diarrhea, gas, bloating, sometimes alternating constipation and diarrhea. But generally with celiac, we are looking at digestive symptoms. That is not always the case. There are actually 4 different types of celiac disease. So celiac disease, by definition, means that people are positive for antibodies to their gut. That's the anti-endomycial and the anti-transglutaminase antibodies. And so those can be tested in the bloodstream. Oftentimes, usually with celiac, people also have a genetic tendency. So these are some HLA genes, and these HLA genes, DQ2 and DQ8, are often positive in people with celiac disease. The third test is to do a biopsy of the small intestine, and that can be done with a scope or with a capsule with a little camera in it that looks down into the gut, and that shows the actual flattening of the villi of the small intestine.
Can you go into that a little bit, because that's a good visual for people to get? So what do the villi do in the small intestine, and what happens, what does the gluten do to the small intestine in somebody with celiac,
yeah.
and how that affects absorption?
So the cells of the small intestine have, each cell has a bunch of little fingers on it, and each of those fingers has even smaller fingers on top of it. So it makes the surface area of the gut giant. In fact, it makes our small intestine our largest organ in our body by surface area. That's really important because the surface area of the gut is necessary to absorb our nutrients, especially our small nutrients like our minerals and vitamins. So if the autoimmune process of celiac actually causes those villi to be eaten away, so that now the cells of the small intestine are flat and they don't have all of that surface area available to them. Without that surface area, we don't absorb nutrients as well. So some of the longer-term consequences of celiac, if we see it in children, we see failure to thrive, we see growth rates being lower, we see much greater increase of osteoporosis later in life, we tend to see anemia. So any of those conditions, we go looking for celiac because we're looking for what's causing this nutrient deficiency, what's keeping this person from absorbing their nutrients well.
And you could have leaky gut on top of that
yes.
going on. You can have both of those things
yes.
happening.
You could have both.
Mm-hmm. Would somebody lose a lot of weight in that condition? Would you typically see weight loss?
Oftentimes in celiac, we do see weight loss. The interesting thing is that in gluten intolerance and sometimes with celiac, we see weight gain. So the body is really good at still absorbing calories, even if it's not absorbing its micronutrients. So it may even experience the world as if it's starving because it's not getting those minerals and vitamins that it needs, and yet it's fully capable of absorbing basic caloric nutrients. And in fact, it gets the sense that it's starving because it doesn't have those micronutrients, and so sometimes it will tack on weight as an adaptive response to feeling like it's starving. So both can happen. Generally, in children with celiac, we do see low weight.
Well, that's really fascinating to think, you know, because I think a lot of people think about somebody with celiac having a weight loss issue, but you're saying that it's they're absorbing, their body's going into starvation mode, so they're just hold on to everything, mm-hmm. but what's not getting in is the actual important micronutrients that are going to feed enzymatic processes and help the body build protein and healthy tissue.
And if a person isn't getting nourished, they're going to want to eat more.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any, do you see any, looks like we're getting close to going on break, so I think what we'll do is take a short break here, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about how gluten intolerance and celiac can be underlying in a lot of the other autoimmune diseases that we see people coming in with.
And there's another question, the question that came in that we want to ask is, hey, bread has been used as a staple for thousands of years in the human diet. So what is it? Is there a changing in the grain? Is there a changing in the population? What's happened? So we want to get into that as well.
Great.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5 on your FM dial. If you'd like to get involved with Radio Free Palmer, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Butte, Chickaloon, and the surrounding areas.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere with Kevin Middleton and Samantha Berg. Hi, everyone. You're listening to The Bridge to Everywhere with Kevin and Sam, and we're interviewing Dr. Amy Chadwick, a naturopathic doctor here in Palmer, Alaska. Her clinic is called Soaring Crane Natural Health Center, and we're speaking about gluten. So one thing we didn't get to is just the four types of celiacs, and maybe you could elaborate on that.
We didn't get to number four. I think that I cut you off in number three.
We talked about, the thing that's important for me to convey here is, even though we're talking about these differences between celiac and gluten intolerance, even in celiac disease, we can have different types. So the typical presentation is where we have all of these symptoms with our gut, diarrhea, gas, bloating, pain, constipation for some. Atypical is there may not be very many gut symptoms, but there might be other manifestations like a skin rash called dermatitis herpetiformis or some other manifestations. And yet when we go to look at the gut, there is still that flattening of the villi. And so we know it is celiac disease and not another form of gluten intolerance. There also can be a silent form where the GI lining is damaged, but there's no apparent symptoms. And then there can be a latent where people can have the genetic tendency, their blood work might be positive, but there's no destruction of the villi yet, and that may develop in time. And we know all that because there is a family tendency to develop celiac disease. So if you have the genetic markers for celiac and other members of your family do as well, oftentimes they fall in one of these other categories. The people who get tested are the ones who have the digestive symptoms, and then the family members find out that they also have this genetic tendency. And it often creates a lot of conversation about whether it's worthwhile for the rest of the family members to go off gluten or not. And there was an interesting study on quality of life for people who chose a gluten-free diet who didn't necessarily have symptoms but were found to be positive for the genetics for celiac disease. And the study showed that quality of life across the board was better 1 year later. So even for people who, you know, had to be inconvenienced by their gluten-free diet, their quality of life was better. They found out that they probably did have some form of symptom year later.
Saying inconvenience is kind of an interesting term. Because in our culture, we're so used to being able to have what we want, when we want it. You know, like, well, I should be able to eat whatever I want to eat. But the thing is, I think what the topic we're going to get into next about various autoimmune conditions and other things that result from gluten-free, even if you don't immediately have a reaction to eating gluten, even if you're not that sensitive, if it's doing damage in your body over time, you know, if you're 20 or 30 right now and you continue to eat the gluten, what's your life going to look like when you're 50 or 60 or 70? You know, what kinds of conditions are going to come up? So I think looking at it in the short term, people think, oh, this is such an inconvenience, it's a pain to do it this way, but really it's like you're taking your health care in your own hands and you're preventing some of these chronic illnesses which often have this gluten intolerance underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
So to take a step back and think, well, is this an inconvenience or is this me actually taking charge of my health? It's going to require a little bit more work, but guess what? I'm going to save myself potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars down the line, and I'm not going to have to take some really harsh medicines mm-hmm. that cause other issues because I won't have those, you know, I won't have some of these conditions when I get older. But, you know, it's the short-sighted, I want what I want right now because it tastes good versus, like, what's the long-term result of what I eat.
Yeah, there's another point on that, which is we get used to what we're used to, and so we may actually be suffering and not even know it.
Right.
That's actually quite common. And so it seems like if you have family members that do test positively or have celiacs or a gluten sensitivity or intolerance, to do it for 4 to 6 weeks anyway, because, you know, you might be shocked at how much better you feel.
Mm-hmm. I have not seen anybody. I mean, it's very rare that I've seen somebody who's willing to take, you know, go on basically an anti-inflammatory diet and at least eliminate the wheat, the gluten, the corn, the soy, you know, and processed dairy, processed foods. 4 to 6 weeks, you know, go on a whole foods diet, basically everybody feels better. There isn't anybody who doesn't feel better.
And lose weight, right? I mean, and it's not because they're not eating enough food, but a lot of people do.
Yes and no. I would say that's, again, sort of become a misnomer about a gluten-free diet, is that it's a weight loss diet. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have an intolerance to gluten, going off gluten will not necessarily create weight loss. Also, if you supplement with a lot of gluten-free labeled foods or processed foods, you may actually gain weight. So there's definitely some, I don't like necessarily touting it as a weight loss diet, and if I'm working with people on weight loss, it may be one of the pieces, but it's only one of those.
Yeah, and I think more what we're talking about is the whole foods, the anti-inflammatory diet. And for some people, we had a little conversation about this before we started. For some people, it may be that they don't do grains at all.
Right.
So taking out all of the grains completely and going with vegetables and, you know, maybe nut flours or coconut flour and, you know, and basically whole foods with no grains. And so that can be huge for people.
And Sam, that's a huge, it's a really, really important point. For me, if somebody's going to choose to try to be gluten-free for 6 to 8 weeks, it is really, really important during that time to focus on whole foods. My definition of whole food is something that was recently growing in the ground or walking or swimming. So as recently as possible, that wasn't boxed or packaged with several ingredients or relabeled or announced loudly that it's healthy in some fancy way or any of those kinds of things. So we're talking about vegetables and fruits and healthy fats. Fish, game meat, spices, you know, playing with your foods that you are not just getting out of an easy package. And that's the other reason why 6 to 8 weeks is really beneficial, is it gives us the time to play with our food and to learn new habits. Because when it comes to food, making these changes isn't easy. We tie cultural things to our food. We tie emotional states to our food. And so when we're talking about something like gluten and wheat, which is sort of considered the main staple of our culture, which we'll get to that in a minute, there can be a lot of angst and stress about having to change that, or there can be a lot of stress from family members about not eating it, and there can be a lot of criticism and frustration that comes out of this choice. And so working with it and looking at what you can eat and how you can make your food something that you're really enjoying rather than this being something that you're being deprived in is really essential.
Sure. We've seen that a lot where somebody really realizes that it's time for them to make the change, but then, you know, they're the mom and there's three kids and there's a dad who won't change, and so they're not getting the support from their family, and it does make it a lot more challenging.
Incredibly
difficult. So everybody out there listening, if you have somebody in your family who's really trying to make that change, it's worth it, and you will feel better too. So that's the, you know, that can be a really tough one, tough hurdle to jump over when only one person in the family is trying to make those changes and nobody else is giving them support. So it's hard to make two or three or four meals.
It's, you know, impossible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't look forward to asking that of anybody, to have to do that and to have to deal with the potential for contamination in their own kitchen. Mm-hmm. You know, our homes and our kitchens ideally are our safe places. And so if you're gluten intolerant and you're trying to cook in your own kitchen and be safe, it's really, really essential for your family to be supportive. And I think that is something to go out to everybody, is I am daily grateful that my husband, though he's not always 100% gluten-free, he always is in our home. And so I never have to worry about that.
And honestly, as a kid, you know, I didn't appreciate that somebody was always cooking for me. You know, so that's the thing. It's like, hey, somebody's cooking for me. I might as well support them in what they want to cook and what they need to cook to keep themselves healthy. Yeah. I think the other thing I wanted to say is that when you talk about what's food and what's not food, I've heard people say, and my favorite line on food is that if your great-great-grandmother would not recognize it as food, then it's not food. And so basically you can go down about two-thirds of the aisles in the supermarket and see things that your great-great-grandmother would not recognize as something that she would want to put in her mouth.
Correct.
And therefore, it's not food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, there's an idea that gluten, that there's a sacrifice, that somehow it's not going to taste good, and that's just not true. You can make incredible dishes without gluten.
You can. I do encourage people to not necessarily expect what they eat to be exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the challenges, is if we're trying to make gluten-free bread taste exactly like Wonder Bread, it's not going to. It may be better once you've played with it and once you've worked with it. I have made amazing desserts that I have friends ask me to bring to their house for events that are gluten-free, that are some of the favorite desserts at that event, but it takes that shifting of not expecting it to necessarily be exactly the same food.
Could you give an example of like a favorite recipe you do?
I have a cake recipe that I've made recently that's made with almond flour and a little bit of sweet rice flour, and it's a yogurt lemon cake that with berries over the top that is amazing. It's available on glutenfreegoddess.com. I've also made gluten-free girls carrot cake that I really like. It has a little bit of xanthan gum in it, and I haven't quite gotten it to work without yet, but it is definitely an excellent carrot cake.
Try ground flaxseed.
I don't know.
I just can't get around that one. Usually I'm pretty kamikaze. I think it's the stickiness factor. It's really sticky and tacky and weird.
It is. The funny thing is, it's used in way more things than we realize. It's a binder in lots of supplements and pills and all kinds of things. But.
Yeah.
You know, I tried a brownie recipe. I think it was from Elena's Pantry, and it was just like almond butter, chocolate, baking powder.
No flour. Almond butter, right?
And maybe eggs.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was amazing.
It tasted like a brownie.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to steer the conversation back to my topic. I really want to get to some of the other issues that can have a gluten intolerance underneath. So some of the autoimmune conditions, and because a lot of people, again, are taking medication for autoimmune conditions, mm-hmm. and they might not necessarily have to take the amount of meds that they're taking, or in some cases, if they take the gluten out, they might not need the meds at all. You just don't know.
Right.
So to recognize that some of these things that are really common in our culture actually have a gluten intolerance underneath them, you know, that a lot of people don't know about it. So I know one of them is Hashimoto's thyroid.
Yeah, that's one of the most common and probably one of the best studied in terms of, we do recognize now that if you have positive thyroid antibodies, then you most likely have a gluten intolerance. The two are linked. And the reason for that is that the protein structure of gluten looks a lot like the protein structure of the thyroperoxidase. And so if those proteins are slipping through the gut, the body will respond to the gluten protein, and it will create the same antibody response to those cells on the thyroid, and therefore create confusion in terms of the way the body responds to thyroid and the thyroid mechanisms. So autoimmune thyroid, I don't have a single patient who comes in who has positive thyroid antibodies that I don't at least look at gluten intolerance. And if we also work at healing the digestive tract and balancing the immune system, then there's the potential that their autoimmunity either goes away or that they become symptom-free or they may not need to be on thyroid medication. That's a big if. The standard research doesn't necessarily show a change in autoimmune thyroid when people go gluten-free, but just going gluten-free often isn't enough when we've developed an autoimmune condition. So we have to actively work to heal the digestive tract, to heal that leaky gut, to look if there's other food intolerances that have developed because of that imbalance, and then to work with balancing the immune system. So
we're seeing so many people diagnosed with hypothyroidism, and they're put on Synthroid, mm-hmm. and they're not necessarily looking at what could be the cause of that. So that would be the person often where they're diagnosed, they have all the low thyroid symptoms, they're diagnosed with hypothyroidism correctly.
Right.
The thyroid's not working properly, and then they're put on Synthroid, and maybe they feel better for a few weeks, and then things just go back, and
right.
then they're never really, it doesn't really fix the problem.
And oftentimes people are not tested for thyroid antibodies. So the standard screening for thyroid is to just look at TSH. And TSH won't tell us whether there's an autoimmune process there or not. It will just tell us the thyroid isn't working very well.
Just for our listeners, TSH is
thyroid-stimulating hormone. It comes from the pituitary. So if people have hypothyroid, I really encourage you to ask your doctor to test antibodies, and then it's worth going into this gluten intolerance discussion at that point.
And the test is called anti-TPO?
Anti-TPO and anti-thyroglobulin, or anti-TG, are the two antibody tests. One of the other common diseases that is associated with gluten intolerance is polycystic ovarian syndrome, and we certainly see a lot of that in our culture as well. It's a hormonal imbalance as well as a blood sugar insulin imbalance that we see in a lot of women. And again, probably this is still being elucidated, but we think that it is also an autoimmune condition where there are antibodies to the ovary itself that are triggering some of that imbalance, and there's a strong connection with gluten intolerance there. Another is type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, we know, is a autoimmune disorder where there are antibodies to the pancreas so that the pancreas can't produce insulin. This is also known as insulin-dependent diabetes, mm-hmm. but generally it's diabetes that often starts in childhood. The pancreas becomes pretty much non-functional, and people have to be on insulin with that illness. Now, being gluten-free doesn't mean that they won't be on insulin. The pancreas does not necessarily recover. But a lot of the long-term effects of that autoimmune process and of managing blood sugar and other things can be helped by working with the gluten
issue. That brings up an interesting thing. Like, if you know that you've got gluten intolerance in your family and you're planning on having kids, that not eating gluten, you know, just quit, like, maybe that could prevent some of the type 1 diabetes. If that's the truth, if that's the underlying issue, then that might be kind of exciting that there's a way to prevent that. Because I've never heard really that, you know, there was a way to stop that from happening.
Right.
So it's possible if we know we've got a family that's got a genetic history of gluten intolerance, that they can go, well, you know, we're not going to eat gluten because we want to have kids and we want to not have that chance that we might have a child with a type 1 diabetes.
Yeah.
That, to me, is real preventative medicine,
it
right?
It is real preventative medicine.
Yeah.
It is. And a lot of that comes in, too, about when we feed our children gluten-containing foods. And that's become part of this conversation about why even people who have genetic markers for celiac may not develop celiac if they're not introduced to gluten too early or too late. And the best introduction is while still breastfeeding. So breastfeeding is preventive, and you want to breastfeed for 2 to 3 months after that first introduction of gluten grains. I tend to recommend not introducing gluten grains until kids are over a year old, but also, if possible, nursing that long to help with that strong intestinal lining.
Great. You know, we had a question come in from a listener in Washington, Julie Webb, and we've kind of been talking about this, but she asked, what exactly is gluten intolerance? And we talked a bit about that. Not the symptoms, but what is actually happening inside the body that reduces the surface area of the villi? And so maybe to review that process one more time, just a little.
Yeah. So in celiac disease, it's an autoimmune disorder where there's actually antibodies that are breaking down the cells of the digestive tract. So that's the mechanism that happens when we've developed an autoimmune reaction to our own gut. In gluten intolerance, we think the mechanism is that the gluten proteins themselves are creating an inflammatory response in the digestive tract that causes this leaky gut to develop, or that causes these cells to break down in their connections between each other. So the villi themselves are healthy. If we did a biopsy of somebody with gluten intolerance who doesn't have celiac, their gut lining would look normal. They might have inflammatory markers, they might not, but the gut itself would look normal on a biopsy. But in a functional sense, they've developed this degree of leaky gut and therefore are getting inflammatory type reactions, and those gluten proteins are causing inflammation in other parts of the body.
So how about some other common inflammatory diseases or autoimmune diseases that you often see connected with gluten?
Arthritis, definitely. Both inflammatory arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, but also osteoarthritis and the inflammatory component with that.
Yep. So psoriasis would go under that, too?
It can. Psoriasis is complicated.
Uh-huh.
So it's often multiple factors, but there is often a gluten component to it.
Anything like MS or Meniere's disease or lupus, any of those kinds of things, would you suspect it?
I would suspect it. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah. There's as we get into those diseases, they become more complicated. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of factors behind them. And so I would not say that gluten intolerance is necessarily the only factor in somebody developing an autoimmune disease like lupus or MS. However, almost all, probably all autoimmune diseases do start in the gut mm-hmm. in one way or another. And so because gluten is such an irritant to the digestive tract, it is one factor, and it's one factor that needs to be eliminated in order to work with that process.
It just seems like the small intestine is so important for absorbing nutrients, and that so if that process isn't working right, you're not starting with the building blocks that you need right. to build healthy proteins and to build enzymes. So if that system isn't working, then you're asking for trouble in all sorts
right.
of other
The small intestine is our main area of forming barriers and boundaries. So when we think about barriers and boundaries, this is barriers and boundaries in terms of what we eat. It's our emotional barriers and boundaries. It's our mental barriers and boundaries. That digestive system has to develop well in childhood in order to have that. It's also the home of our biggest kind of host of our immune system. And so it is constantly making the decision, is this me, is this not me? Is this food, is this not food? And as it's making those decisions, there's a lot of room for it to get confused. So a lot of the connections here are that people may have a tendency for a gluten intolerance, and then they get a viral infection of the gut, or then they experience a strong stressor that also creates strain on the digestive tract. And it takes that secondary trigger to move somebody into gluten intolerance or celiac disease, because that gut really requires healthy blood flow, low stress environment, healthy foods, and then the right nutrients to keep it going. And if any of those factors get disturbed or we get some severe viral illness, there's the potential for these intolerances to develop.
Great. We have another question that came in on our Facebook page, and this is from Michael and Palmer. It says, so will wheat-derived alcohols cause a gluten problem?
You might know who this Michael is. Yes, wheat-derived alcohols can cause a problem. So with people with gluten intolerance, it is really important to look at all sources of gluten, including alcohol. There's some theory that once an alcohol is distilled, there's no gluten in it. What I've found in clinical practice is that alcohol has to be really, really, really well distilled for there to be no gluten in it. And sometimes that's not even enough.
So let's talk a little bit about why the gluten intolerance has become such a huge issue.
Yeah, what's wrong with us? I mean, my grandmother could eat bread. And, you know, I mean, this is really a shift, right, a cultural shift that's happening.
Well, also, though, when we were in Rome, though, didn't we learn that in Italy they have some of the highest incident of celiac disease in Italy, and they eat a lot of bread? I just assumed that it was less of a problem because of the quality of the bread. But apparently, I mean, a lot when we were in Florence, all the menus had gluten-free options, and that surprised me. So I know that the quality of food there is quite a bit different than the quality of food. They only allow 5 different additives in the food, and they're not doing GMO, you know, genetically modified food, and there's still a significant portion of the population.
Right, and I mean, Samantha was eating way too many cannolis the whole time. But really there was less reaction.
Yeah.
I found, you know,
we did notice that, and the statistic was that there are a lot more people in Italy than anywhere else who have gluten intolerance, which surprised me because I thought, well, that the quality, so it can't just be a quality thing, but
correct.
Some of it could be quality.
Correct.
Right.
So that comes back to the difference between the genetic tendency and then also what we've done to the grain, and both are factors. Western Europe has for a very long time been known to have a much higher rate of genetic tendency to have celiac disease. And in fact, this has been an issue with diagnosis in terms of, it was a few years ago, it was known that in Europe, you know, 1 to 3 in 100 people had celiac disease. And it was thought that in the United States, no more than 1 in 300 to 1 in 1,000 have celiac disease. New studies are definitely showing that it's pretty much even across the board as to how many people do have celiac disease, somewhere in the range of 1 to 3 in 100. So some of that is a genetic tendency, regardless of the quality of the wheat. And we could certainly have the conversation about whether or not grains have been a healthy thing for humans in general, and that the advent of agriculture and the production of grains and the utilization of grains and baked goods, whether that's a good idea or not.
We'll be having a panel discussion on that. Because I've got some strong opinions on whether. Yeah. And the Chinese actually will say, if you look back in texts written about around 1280, they actually refer to grains as being the source of the, was it the 10,000 vexations or something?
Mm-hmm. That, might have been 1,000 vexations.
It's a lot. It's the point at which we introduced that we became an agricultural society, and we started staying put and cultivating grains, that a lot of the modern diseases show up in the fossil record.
Correct. Yeah. And we do see that. So that's kind of a bigger discussion. There's also the issue that gluten is that the wheat that we raise here in the United States has been hybridized to be much higher in the gluten protein. So we didn't really get into what that is, but the gluten is a protein that is in wheat, spelt, rye, triticale, barley. And that protein itself, we can hybridize the grains in order to be higher in the protein so that it makes a really nice, light, fluffy bread that can be made on mechanized machines at a Wonder Bread factory. So there's a... that probably has not helped in terms of our development of gluten intolerance to have increased the level of gluten that's in all of our diets. Not only in breads, but gluten is a great binder. So it's used in spice mixes and condiments and all prepared foods. So our exposure to gluten and our exposure to gluten from a very young age and on has really magnified in the last several years as we've moved away from more whole foods diets and more farm lifestyle to eating processed foods.
I'm kind of cracking up now that we didn't actually define what gluten was at the beginning of the conversation. That's great. So everybody listening right now thinks that gluten is from outer space. The aliens brought gluten here. So now you know what gluten is. Glad we got to that point 4 minutes before the end. That's pretty good.
Well, good. Full circle. But I've got my own little gluten story. About 10 years ago, I was really on a pizza-making kick, and I really wanted to make the perfect pizza. And I talked to a pizzeria in the area that I was living at the time, and the guy said, you got to get a high gluten flour, and it creates a little more chew, and it just has the right texture for that pizzeria dough texture. So I went out and I got like a big bag of gluten.
Yes, as a protein.
And if a little is good, a lot is a lot better. You know, so I was making these great pizza crusts and I was making fantastic pizzas, and I just, you know, would fall asleep on the couch. That's totally normal. You know,
normal gluten coma.
But, you know, one of the things that I noticed when I did take gluten out is something that I had been developing would be like I'd lay down at night to go to bed, and all of a sudden it would be like somebody turned 5 radio stations on in my head. I would just have all this mental noise and be very hard to fall asleep. And, I was just kind of, getting used to that. And when I took gluten out, it was amazing. It totally disappeared like that. I mean, mm-hmm. It probably took a couple of days, but then I tested it because I didn't want to give up my bread like everybody else. And so, I put a little bit of it back, and of course it came right back. The other symptom I noticed is maybe a little low-grade agitation, like a little, background buzz in the nervous system, a little irritability, and that totally went away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking, there's a when I was in college, there was this stuff that came in a can. It was a Chinese food, and it was braised gluten. It's like gluten with a brown sauce. It's probably like lots of soy and lots of MSG. It was just, and I loved it. I thought it was doing something healthy because it was vegetarian protein, right?
Correct.
So a lot of people use braised gluten in their food.
Gluten is often added to vegan and vegetarian cooking as an added protein.
Yeah.
And again, not helping our gluten intolerance.
Right. You feel like you're eating meat, like you're having, it's kind of chewy, mm-hmm. like you're having a meat experience. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So any thoughts about making a cooking class in town here?
There are lots of thoughts about that.
I bet people would love it.
Yeah, it's in the works. I think I would love to hear interest, and I would even love it if somebody else wanted to teach mm-hmm. parts of it. That would be fabulous.
There was somebody in Wasilla teaching classes, isn't it? Gluten-Free Central?
Gluten-Free Central, she's not in operation
now.
All right. There's a wonderful blog, Made in AK, MAIDINAK.com, who she does a lot of anti-inflammatory cooking, including gluten-free, and she puts a lot of pointers on her site. And she's done a couple of classes out of my clinic, and maybe eventually we'll get more there. She's working on a cookbook. But together we're working on some options. So
great.
Great. So if anybody is listening and would like to actually take a cooking class with Dr. Amy Chadwick, go to our Facebook page and just put that right up there. Just express your interest and we'll pass that along.
Yeah. If we have interest, we'll do it.
So any last comments here as we're wrapping up? How for folks that want to follow up with you, what would they do? Your clinic number, website?
Yeah, so it's Soaring Crane Natural Health Center, and the website is www.soaringcraneclinic.com. Or the phone number is 745-3999. And definitely call. I do 15-minute consults if you just want to meet me more than just a voice on the radio and see if we can work together. Or we can also schedule an appointment and work and see, you know, if gluten is one of your issues or if there are any other health concerns.
And if anybody wants to learn yoga, what are your classes that you're teaching?
I am also a yoga instructor. I'm currently teaching Wednesday nights at Anjali Studio at 5:30.
Great.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks, everybody out there, for joining us. And next time we'll have Kim Kraft, who's a physical therapist from Advanced Physical Therapy, on the show. So have a great evening. Thank you, everyone.
Have a great gluten-free night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks, Dr. Chadwick.
Palmer, Alaska.
Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.